Wednesday House Call is presented by Robillard Hearing Centers. Hearing is believing.com.
Tell me something I don't know.
Without mucus, your stomach would digest itself.
Tell me something else I don't know. Something less disturbing.
Is he going to be all right, Doctor? Is he going to live?
It's a stick.
Damn it, don't give me that medical jargon. Just tell me straight. Is he going to be okay?
We are committing genetic fraud.
He's not kidding. You look really awful. You need medical assistance.
So, what do you got there?
Oh, I baked some fat-free goodies for your trip. And there's a ton of muffins if anybody wants one.
Oh, not for me. I have some problems with allergies.
Really? Well, these are just wheat germ, oak bran, and carob.
Oh, they'll throw in a sea scallop. You can call the paramedics right now.
Wednesday afternoon brings Dr. Barry Dworkin into the Hal Anthony studio, ready to take your health-related questions at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility or 1-800-580-CFRA, toll-free. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
And let's get right to the phones. We've got people waiting already. Ivan.
Good afternoon.
Yes, afternoon.
Sir. Go ahead.
In an effort to reduce some of my excess avoirdupois after the Christmas feeding frenzy, I've been the last week or so following the advice of my doctor, pushing away from the table.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I've noticed any big difference in a week. But looking at the news last night at Chief Spence, after a month of not eating anything solid, she doesn't seem to have lost a pound. Still has the double chins and the fat pot belly and the thick legs and everything. How can that be? Is this pushing away from the table just a medical myth?
No, pushing. the nuance to this question is such that
In order
to lose weight, you have to reduce your calories. That's the bottom line. So pushing away from the table, implying that you have less calories being taken in. Yes, you would expect to lose weight. Given that I don't have any information about Chief Spence other than the appearance. I can't comment any further. I'll leave that for our audience to decide. All I can say is that if someone is truly not taking in enough calories over a month, and you make an assumption that if they are claiming to be on a strike, for a hunger strike, usually that implies that you are starving yourself. And if someone is starving themselves, normally people require 1,200 calories a day to just maintain the normal body functions. Now, if someone weighs a bit more, that tends to be greater because there's literally more mass to keep warm. So the body's metabolism has to work more. So they tend to require more calories in order to maintain their body weight. But nevertheless, in a starvation state, you would expect someone to lose weight relatively quickly over a month if you have a deficiency of, even if we're to say, 1,000 calories negative balance a day. Let's just use that as an example. So that would be 30,000 calories in a month, and 3,500 calories is approximately a pound. So you would expect that person to lose at least 8 pounds, probably more because they lose water with that as well. So, you know, I'll leave it for people to decide on whether they think this is something that she has been doing.
It'd be purely speculation on our part. Susan.
Hello,
Susan. Hi. Go ahead.
I go to the gym quite often,
mm-hmm.
and the gym that I go to just recently changed their floor from a hardwood to a rubber,
okay.
a black rubber. It looks like tiles all put together.
Yes.
I find it's very porous, and I'm a bit of a germaphobe, and we're doing a lot of exercises on the floor, push-ups, burpees, all that kind of stuff, and I'm just wondering, I mean, you know, with people sweating and stuff, like how hygienic are those floors?
Well, they have to be cleaned like anything else. I mean, they are actually easier on a person's limbs, on their back, in terms of effect on the joints, because you're not exercising on a solid surface. You don't get the jarring effect.
Yeah, but I've noticed that right away.
Yeah. And it's really, when you think of it, it's really no different than some of the exercise machines that are being used that have the coverings on them. They have to be, it has to be wiped down and cleaned every night. But again, some of the stuff, the usual stuff is, again, just, you know, if you're going to be exercising, you're going to be around people anyway. I mean, the other thing to consider is at times when you're exercising with other people, people are sweaty and you touch them and they're sweaty anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it's washing your hands afterwards and you know, taking a shower. And again, we can't prevent everything in the world in terms of becoming infected. But for the most part, in gym situations where you're exercising, it's not very likely. The most likely thing you're going to get are colds from people, especially this time of year, as opposed to any other serious type of infection.
Right.
The only other things that might be more likely to be transmitted, I mean, hepatitis B is one of those things that's found in sweat. So people usually get vaccinated for hepatitis B, especially when they travel. So that's something that people may want to consider if they're going to be in situations where they may get cuts and bruises and be exposed to bodily fluids. So, but otherwise, I wouldn't be overly concerned from the floor itself as a means of transmitting that infection around.
Colin is up next on CFRA. Go ahead, Colin.
Yes, well, as a man who has a lot of money invested in his body, and I don't mean in gym membership, this is the time of year when lots of us are saying, okay, this is the year I'm going to smarten up. And a wise doctor, a very wise doctor, recommended a book that I should read probably 3 years ago when I first went to him. You'll know who that doctor is in a minute. And it's called Mindless Eating.
Yes.
And I decided over the Christmas break to start reading it. And I'm probably halfway through it now. And I realized that that book was written about me, the author I've never met. But it's definitely a book that if people are thinking about just making a few lifestyle changes that will make a difference, I've started to implement them, and you really do realize that you eat for a lot of times really stupidly calories you don't need.
Yeah, it's an excellent book. It's by Dr. Brian Wansink. I interviewed him on my radio show, and the interview is still on my website if people want to listen to the interview with him. But it is very telling because he has a lot of examples. He's the director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University, and he's done a lot of research into how our environment influences our eating, who we are eating with. You know, if you're eating alone, if you take that as your baseline, Rob, of eating alone being the most you'll eat. If you eat with one other person, you're eating 25% more, whether you think you're doing it or not. And if you're with a group of people, especially think of Christmas time, if you're with six people or more at the table, you will eat 100% more food than you normally would if you ate alone. So, and there's countless other examples of people eating food even after they're stuffed after a five-course meal, continuing to eat soup that was fed by a soup tureen, by a tube running to soup bowls, and not even noticing that the soup wasn't running out while they're talking at the table.
The size of the plates.
The
right?
size of the plates
you'll
make a huge difference.
If it's on a bigger plate.
Well, you put more on a bigger plate.
You'll put more on a bigger plate.
You'll fill up your plate. Yeah. So, you know, he did an interesting experiment where he had people go up and serve themselves, and they were given a small plate first to go up, and that plate was weighed, and then they took the plate over to the person to serve them. The person sneezed on the plate by accident in order to get them to take a larger plate to go up again. They went up again. They were served the food, and they were asked, what do you think, which plate actually had the most food on it? And they said, oh, the smaller plate seemed to have more food on it. But in fact, 40% more food was on the larger plate, and they ate what was on the larger plate. So it's really our eyes tell us something that is not necessarily true.
So, Colin, you're wasting away, are you?
It's a great book and really simple things to make little changes, and I'm going to try it this year.
That's great.
Thanks for calling in, Colin.
Thanks.
Happy New Year, buddy.
You too.
Good to hear from you. 521-TALK, folks, *580 or 1-800-580-CFRA. And Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's the Wednesday house call. We're just waiting we're getting a caller on the line here. And here we go with Sean in Westboro. Sean.
Good afternoon.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Doc.
Hi.
I listen to you all the time. I think you're great.
Thank you.
I have a ostomy, and I'm passing a lot of clots through my stoma.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only started, I've had the bag for about 8 months.
Okay.
But the clotting has just about, well, it's about 2 months now, or a month and a half, and I was wondering why it would just come on like that?
There likely is something that's damaged with the ostomy. If there's clotting or bleeding, then there's some tissue that likely is damaged. So you.
So I
don't know when the last time you had that looked at, just to follow it up, if your surgeon has seen it or not. But
I'm waiting for my surgeon to come back from down south.
Yeah, I you know, if this has been going on for a while where you've had blood clots, the blood has to be coming from somewhere. There should not be bleeding from an ostomy, right?
No.
So there likely is either where it's attached, it's torn, or there's some damage, or the skin is ulcerating a little bit. But it has to be looked at to see what exactly is causing the problem. But it certainly isn't normal, Sean. And so I would have this. I probably wouldn't wait too long. You know, don't just wait for your surgeon to come up from down south or wherever they are. You know, if it's going to be weeks before they even see you, I would prefer if you were to be even, if you can, even to go to the eMERGE, if only because we don't know how much blood is being lost.
Yeah.
And if there's constant blood loss, we need to know how much has been lost, because it can be more than you think, and that can lead to anemia and other problems.
Yeah, I see it in my bag in the morning.
Yeah.
I notice that the redness, and I also notice the clots, too, that are forming at the top of the bag.
Yeah. So I would say that this is something that is an active problem.
It
right?
warrants an investigation.
Yeah, it warrants an investigation because, again, the unknowns are how much blood is being lost, where the blood loss is coming from. And so you can't just go days and days or weeks without knowing, because that can add up to be a lot of blood loss.
Okay.
Could it be, Barry, my diet or something?
Diets would not be something that would cause clots, right? The clot is actually from bleeding. So the bleeding is coming from somewhere, especially if you're noticing that in the bag. And so it really, I would want to rule out more serious
things. So if he's in Westboro,
he
should probably get to the Civic and go to the emergency room.
And just say that you're bleeding and that he needs to be evaluated.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right. I'm going to take another call here. Good luck, Sean. Kevin.
Hi there.
Yeah.
Hi. Often, I guess a couple of times a week while I'm asleep on my back or on my side, I'll wake up in the middle of the night, like at 3 in the morning, with a severe chest pain. And I noticed that if I start burping, the pain goes away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know what that might be. You know, the first thing obviously comes to your head is could be your heart. But as soon as I start burping, the chest pain goes away. On occasion, I've felt a sharp chest pain on my left side of my chest where it did wake me up.
Mm-hmm.
It hurt for about a minute, and then it went away, and then I fell back asleep.
Well, usually if you're waking up with chest pain, it's unlikely to be cardiac. And the reason is that if we make an assumption that a heart attack or angina is because the heart is receiving less blood or oxygen, then if that's happening when you are at rest or sleeping, it means that there's quite a severe blockage. And we call that unstable angina, because it blocks up without even you doing anything. But if you're not having any chest pain when you're moving around, then it's very unlikely to be unstable angina, because you would immediately get this kind of chest pain when you're trying to do anything. So it's unlikely to be cardiac. Also, it's not lasting very long. You can have...
So what could it be?
Well, what happens at night is that you tend to have more acid production in your stomach. So the gas that... You can have gas that builds up. You can have reflux that builds up. The reflux can sometimes irritate the esophagus, which is also in the same area, passes right beside the heart, can give you the chest pain. The burping in and of itself can alleviate a lot of pressure that's there, so that can help. So what I would look at is more of a gas, more of the stomach as the reason, with possible reflux that's leading to this, as opposed to it being heart. And so there are specific things that can be done to check and see if that's the case. And that's where I would speak to your physician, because you may want to reduce the acid production. You may want to have more evaluation done, look for other things that could cause stomach upset. But usually nighttime, waking up at night with that kind of pain usually implies gastric reflux. But it's not the only thing, but that would be the first thing on my mind, given that he also has a lot of that gas in his stomach.
We'll be back after the news with more of your phone calls for Dr. Barry Dworkin.
My name's John Wing. Wing is a Chinese name. In Chinese, it means the arm of a bird. I wanted to be a doctor, but I realized pretty early that they'd never name part of a hospital after me. Excuse me, I'm looking for the Wing Wing. Excuse me. The Wing Wing.
Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's time for the Wednesday House Call second half here. Every single phone line is available, folks. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, or 1-800-580-CFRA. So two big local health stories, obviously, yes. This week. Men collapsing in gyms.
Yeah.
We've talked about this in the past, whether it's New Year's resolution time or...
Right.
Shoveling snow, things can happen.
Exactly.
And we always hear, and I don't pay attention, and I'm sure the vast majority of people don't pay attention, always consult your physician before you
right.
undertake some kind of exercise regimen. What are you going to say? I come to you and say, Barry, it's time for me to get into shape. What right. are you going to do? What are you going to do to me?
Well, the first thing is to, depends on a person's age.
Right.
So, predictions are, frankly, rife with error. So I'm not one to predict things for people in the
right.
future. So you can
sure.
only go by the data that you're presented with now. So yeah. if say someone comes in, let's say they're 40, 45, 50.
Let's say they're 41.
Okay. And they may be a bit overweight.
Yes.
So you want to do a few things. You want to check blood sugar levels. You want to check cholesterol levels. You want to calculate and check blood pressure. You want to calculate what that person's risk of cardiovascular disease is, because if they have an elevated risk, so normally it's based on your age,
yep.
your total cholesterol, your blood pressure, whether you're smoking, whether there's a family history of high blood pressure or cardiovascular disease, and amongst other factors that they'll go into this calculation. And on the basis of that, you end up in a low, medium, or high risk category. And depending on those categories, you usually have to treat or do something to reduce that risk. So someone that says that someone has a moderate risk of cardiovascular disease. So you want to treat them to reduce their blood pressure. You don't want them going exercising if their blood pressure is elevated. So say, for example, they have high blood pressure. So you want to control for that. You want to reduce their cholesterol levels to reduce any particular harm to the heart. Now, whether that in and of itself, you go next week and you start exercising, is going to protect you, mm-hmm. it probably is not. Right. If your coronary arteries are already blocked, or if you have an increased risk of heart disease, when you start treatment, it takes years for treatment to reverse some of the damage. But nevertheless, what it does mean, though, is if you know that you have an increased risk, you don't start doing sports that put a huge demand on your heart. You start slowly. You may want to get a trainer to help you with starting slow, not overexerting yourself, not lifting heavy weights and doing immediate demand work, which is what snow shoveling is. And you end up with a heart attack. So again, it's your underlying health risks that are assessed, and on the basis of that, you can make recommendations. Someone who's 25 years old is healthy. Don't come in and see me. The only time they come in and see me is when someone wants me to take responsibility for that person if they're going on a camping trip, or they're going and participating in some sporting event, or going to a lot of times in the U.S., their universities want a clearance so that they can participate in football or whatever. And so it becomes literally a CYA type of situation where it's yeah. the physician has to fill out that form.
Let me ask you, because you and I are generally opposed to the overreaching arm of government and regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed, right? That's
mm-hmm.
just not the way we are built. But nevertheless, do you think it should be almost mandatory for fitness facilities to have these defibrillators in place?
For fitness facilities, I'd say yes.
Yeah.
And the reason is that when you're looking at, again, when you're trying to assess risk,
right.
you have to ask yourself, in that particular environment, is there a greater risk of someone having cardiac arrhythmia, cardiac arrest?
Like we reported yesterday, for example, this fellow who was in, I believe he was 62 or what
right.
have you, and collapsed
yeah.
at the OAC.
Right.
The OAC has three of these defibrillators.
Defibrillators. Correct.
They cost $1,100 each.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a worthwhile investment
for a life-saving piece of equipment, right? It's not a lot of money for that kind of equipment. And
yeah.
if you have a gym where you have members of all ages
yeah.
with all various health risks, some people are going specifically because they have a risk and they want to
sure.
reduce their risk.
Yeah.
So absolutely, you want to have available anything that is proven to be helpful to someone in that emergency situation. You don't want to buy superfluous things that are not going to help. So, for example, if you have a gym that is just as an extreme example, a gym that has people that are in their 20s and 30s without any health problems, and that's the only people that actually go there, having a defibrillator is unlikely to be very cost-effective because it's unlikely you're going to have someone in that group that is going to have that problem. But the reality is that most gyms don't have just a narrow selection of a population. It's usually a wide-ranging with all kinds of health problems. And so, and you're not controlling for the type of activity that people are doing. Some people are using a treadmill and just walking. Others are really pushing it with an incline. Others are doing heavy weights. Others are doing lighter weights. So you have to take into account that in that environment, there is a much greater chance of someone having a problem than in a McDonald's or something. Yeah. You know,
amazing. You can just shock the heart back, right?
Well, it's not as simple as that. I mean, it's if you have a situation of what's called asystole, where the heart is not beating at all, it's dependent on how long it stays like that. It also is a matter of what caused it in the first place. If it's an arrhythmia, that is where it isn't the heart that became damaged. There's no heart attack per se. There's no lack of blood flow to the heart, where the heart suddenly, the electrical conduction short-circuited, and as a result, the heart started to beat crazily and then stopped. That's more likely to work with a defibrillator than someone who has had a major heart attack and the heart has stopped. And the reason is, although it still can help, the reason is that when you're shocking a heart that has no physical damage to it, it's more likely to work again, as opposed to a heart that has had a major heart attack where the bulk of the heart muscle is actually dead.
Yeah.
And so it's much more difficult because the shock is designed to literally boot up the electrical system in the heart to get it to contract again. And if you have areas of the heart that have now died, that electrical system has died as well. The wires have been literally destroyed. Yeah. And so the defibrillators are a tool, but you can't depend on those to bring everybody back. It's going to work for a lot of people, but it really is dependent on what we call the pathophysiology or the mechanism of what caused it in the first place that led to the condition.
Still plenty of phone lines available, folks, at 521-TALK, *580 or 1-800-580-CFRA. Dorothy.
Yes, sir.
Yes, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I had an echocardiogram in September, and I was diagnosed with diastolic dysfunction.
Dysfunction, yes.
Apparently, it's fairly new. I don't know much about it. Grade 2 on the left ventricle.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm concerned about, at the time, the doctor there was quite happy with my heart rate, et cetera, and didn't seem too concerned about anything, and also my GP. I was wondering, should I be seeing a cardiologist for this? I don't know much about it, and it's very hard for me to understand. And there is a history of a lot of heart problems in my family. My parents have passed away, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if this is really worth being concerned about. They didn't seem to be too concerned about it at all.
In diastolic dysfunction, from an echocardiogram standpoint, is a measure of how what your heart is doing in its resting phase, right? There are two phases. There's systolic, and that's when your heart is beating. So when you take your blood pressure and you hear the number 120 over 80, the 120 is the pressure generated by the heart when it's contracting, and the 80 is the pressure in between when the heart is resting, and that's called the diastolic pressure.
I see.
And so diastolic dysfunction is when you have sort of the walls of the heart that generate the pressure are stiffer. And so they can't, you end up having sort of an elevated pressure. The heart doesn't stretch as much. And you can sometimes have a reduction in the ability of the heart to circulate blood into your body.
I must say that I am on a lot of blood pressure pills and have been for several years.
If there is some diastolic dysfunction, and they're on the echo, they're showing that the heart muscle has been damaged, and that's something that you want to see on that if there is any damage. It certainly could be helpful to see a cardiologist just to have their opinion about whether anything else needs to be done. You're already on medications to treat your blood pressure, and if your blood pressure is maintained and it's stable, there likely isn't too much else to do to control that, because ultimately it's controlling blood pressure to help that in the first place.
So the important thing is your blood pressure.
Correct.
I see. That's what I kind of thought, but because of history in my family, I'm extremely healthy for my age, which is 78.
Right.
And I want to stay that way.
Yeah, so the general principles for treating sort of diastolic dysfunction is, again, it's controlling the blood pressure really well. It's making sure that your heart rate is normal, to make sure that your lungs are clear, that you're not congested, that there's no fluid buildup in the lungs, that you don't have atrial fibrillation. Those are the and if there's any coronary artery disease, then that's controlled as well. So those are the things that we look at when looking at treating diastolic dysfunction. And if those have been taken care of, then it's pretty much the bases are covered.
I see. Okay, I think you've answered my question.
All right.
Thank
Good
you
luck,
very
Dorothy.
Much.
Welcome, Thanks
Dorothy.
For calling. This will be the last call on the Wednesday House Call. It's Jess. Go ahead, Jess.
Yes, I would like the doctor to address a disease called labyrinthitis.
Yes.
And could you also tell us something about, I think it's called the Epney maneuver?
Yeah, sure.
And also whether the Epney maneuver can be done by the patient on himself.
Absolutely.
Thank
so,
you.
So vestibular disease or labyrinthitis has to do with the balance organs that are localized in the sort of in the ear area, but embedded in the skull. It's very small. It's literally, I'd say it's maybe half a centimeter or less in size. There's on both sides of the head. They're comprised of three circles or semicircles at right angles to each other. So think of X, Y, and Z in three dimensions. And it basically measures how you're moving in three dimensions. There's fluid inside. The fluid moves. You turn your head left, right, up, down, side to side. And it'll tell your brain where you're moving. Sometimes that fluid gets blocked up by a little crystal that gets blocked in this canal. And because it stops the fluid from moving, you know, when you turn your head, Rob, your eyes will move at the same time. And your brain matches your eye movement with the actual feeling of three dimensions of how you're turning, and that keeps you balanced. But when your eyes move and the fluid doesn't move, you get nauseated and you feel dizzy because your brain gets two different inputs. It's delayed, and so you end up getting very dizzy. The Epley maneuver is a maneuver that it's a series of moves of the head that will help dislodge this crystal. Works about 80% of the time. Mm. And there is a device, and I forget the name of the device. One of the listeners had sent me a question about it, and it actually is quite intriguing and works very well. It's a device that you put on your head that literally creates in front of you, it sits in front of you, a three-dimensional representation of what your balance organ is. And it helps you make the Epley maneuver. It shows you how to turn your head. There's a guide on it that shows you how to turn your head to actually get rid of that crystal yourself without having to go see a neurologist to have it done. And it's quite effective. And you can look up Epley maneuver and device, and it probably would come up on Google. But it is something that will help. So the answer to the question is yes, you can do that on your own. It is about 80% successful to do that. And it helps unblock the tube and your nausea and dizziness goes away.
Amazing. Good to see you this week.
See you
Thanks
too.
For coming in, Dr. Barry
Thank
Dworkin in the Wednesday House Call. You back on Sunday?
Back on Sunday.
Sundays at 4 with the Sunday House Call. Health headlines every morning during Madeley in the morning.